we got a little freak show.
What we're really understanding is that the technocracy is not serving us. The idea that a wise, seasoned, technocratic, corporate elite can guide us gently into the future just seems clearly not to be working.
He's a neo-psychedelic pioneer, writer, talk show host, musician, and political theorist. Are You Serious? Joins Plutopia News Network's John Lepkoski and Scoop Sweeney in a wide-ranging interview on 20 Minutes Into the Future.
Our guest today is Are You Serious? The former editor, most recently, of H+, the online magazine. And back in the 90s, RU was the editor of Mondo 2000, which was a formative experience for many of us, falling into Mondo 2000 and its predecessor, Reality Hackers. Let's jump right into the story of your life. Did you have a master plan, or have you just been kind of winging it throughout?
Oh, I would say largely I've been winging it. No, I had no clue what to do with myself and what to do with my life. I'm very poor at working with my hands and was not very good at concentrating and learning in school. So, I was a drifter who slowly found his way into writing, editing, attempting to sing songs and write lyrics, and looking for the edge, the revolution, something happening that would be exciting and worthwhile. And since then, I've been stumbling into the in and out of the zeitgeist, I guess, on occasion. As far as master plans go, there is an article or rather an introduction to the Mondo 2000 history book that I'm working on that is posted on 10 Zen Monkeys, where I talk about a psychedelic trip, LSD trip that I took just a few days after John Lennon was shot that resulted in my general concept, my three-sentence idea for what to do with my life, which was to move to California and start the neo-psychedelic movement, start a neo-psychedelic band, and start a neo-psychedelic magazine. So I suppose to a certain extent I did follow my plan and follow my own acid-infused instructions to at least attempt to do those things.
How do you make the distinction between psychedelic and neo-psychedelic?
Well, I mean, it was, three letters. I guess it was original to me. I maybe somebody else had suggested the idea of neo-psychedelia before I had. But, it was around 1980, 1981. I was living in Rochester, New York. I was as a sort of musician, art person, alternative cultural person, I was into punk and new wave as opposed to being into all the old dusty hippie bands. And I was also into sort of futurism that was being purveyed by Timothy Leary and Robert Anton Wilson, and to some extent by Stuart Brand, William Burroughs. So it felt kind of neo. It felt, technologically forward-thinking and embracing the speed of culture that was sort of communicated by in the mid-70s, first by the music of the Ramones, it's just kind of like, well, what's the difference here? Oh, just make things faster. I think the Beatles did that in 1963, actually, and then the Ramones did it again. So this sense of speed, of embracing the speed of culture and technology as opposed to sort of standing outside it and feeling overwhelmed by it, might be a distinction between the neo-psychedelic idea and the psychedelic sensibility that had preceded it.
Somewhere in the back of my mind, I have sort of contrasting scenes of sort of like the prototypical view of an acid dance in some 60s film where people are sort of waving sinewy in the wind of their psychedelic experience versus, mm-hmm. you know, the punk scene where people were just slamming really hard, you know, and slamming into each other and slam dancing, as we called it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I'm remembering, you mentioned Stuart Brand. Stuart wrote a piece one time about the punk scene where he pointed out that the punks actually seemed to him to be sort of gentler and more humane than the people he had known in the hippie scene back in the 60s and late early 70s.
Yeah, well, I mean, I had been in college in the late 70s and early 80s. And in college, you tend to be very tribal. So I mean, there's this sort of rivalry between the sort of deadheads who hung out in one place and were actually pretty conservative. And to a great extent, many of them were jocks at the college where I was, and the sort of art scene who where people were picking up on new wave and on punk and on avant-garde stuff and so forth. So from that perspective, sort of dusty old hippie types, the deadheads and all that seemed reactionary to me. Now I move out to San Francisco, or to be specific, I moved to Berkeley. And then to Mill Valley, oddly enough, and start this neo-psychedelic magazine, and all the types come inside, you know, the hippies, the deadheads, the punks, young, old, academics, the people who work in the laboratories designing new drugs, the digital culture people, all these people start to come in, and I become a very accepting person because this is you know, a varied and a very dynamic and fun community to be in and a part of and to help give expression to.
You got, part of that scene was people who were building computers and haptics and that sort of thing, correct?
Yeah, well, I mean, pretty early on, I mean, I started first with High Frontiers, the magazine of psychedelic science, reverence, and modern art. In 1984, pretty quickly, I discovered that people who would respond to this, a fairly large number of them were from Silicon Valley, and there were people who were making hardware and software for an industry that was still very young. This was, a turn on and a bit of a shock. In a funny sort of way, to realize that the people who are making the next economy, many of them were, you know, liked what I was doing, you know.
Yeah, they were tripping, right?
Yeah, they were either former psychedelic people who still, you know, valued the experience they had had, or they were still very much part of that, and you know, they were interested in the sort of anti-authoritarianism that was around in the 60s and 70s, and that was identified with the counterculture. You know, I mean, I think there are people on the sort of on the boundary between counterculture and mainstream culture, you know, on the boundary between being alternative and being very middle class, or you know, eventually becoming very rich, in fact. So, I mean, there are all these interesting sort of boundaries and conceptual border crossings going on in front of me that I had to think about and cope with and generally just accept as being a goodness in terms of doing this project.
You talk about the old counterculture psychedelic figures. You got Timothy Leary involved with Mondo 2000, and he's pretty much a key person in the old psychedelic culture. How did you find that relationship?
Well, I mean, I was, as I said before, I became a very much a Leary fan in the mid-late 70s when I started reading his future history books. Before that, he was just another person in the deck of cards of the counterculture who, you know, I had mixed feelings about, but always enjoyed his writing. I started reading his future history stuff, really was about the upcoming wired culture, the culture of minds connected and of biotechnology and eventually nanotechnology and all of that. And I was just very turned on by the way he dealt with it and the way his friend Robert Anton Wilson dealt with it. I met him in Rochester, actually. He was going around on his stand-up philosophy tour. And got a chance to interview him with some friends then for an avant-garde art magazine called Black Veins. Then when we started High Frontiers in 84, he actually called me before the magazine had even started. These two guys, Bruce Eisner and Peter Stafford. Peter Stafford had edited, created the Psychedelics Encyclopedia, a really seminal book in psychedelic culture. And they came over. They had heard that I was doing this magazine, and they came over to meet me. And they said in this sort of mock serious tone that the Commodore wants to know why you haven't contacted him yet. And they got on the phone with Timothy, and I was actually a little nervous, but he was very jovial and friendly and happy that I was doing this psychedelic magazine with the idea that there would be science and technology and perhaps more importantly irreverence involved in it. And so right from the beginning he was supportive, and we interviewed him and ran interviews with him and visited him down in Los Angeles. At that time he was living in North Hollywood. And it just went on from there. He's always pretty much completely supportive, never asked for any payment for the work that he did. Did lots of interviews for us, contributed to William Gibson interview, David Byrne, a few others, and articles and so forth. So, he was just, he would even come up for meetings once in a while, come up to Berkeley. Not just for meetings, he would have other purposes for coming up there, but they, come and sit around the kitchen table, particularly, during the Mondo 2000 whichever. He would come and participate in discussions about what to do and so forth. So he was a contributing editor.
So how did Reality Hackers happen after High Frontiers?
We're groping around for what to do. One of the things, I started High Frontiers, just on pure inspiration, without a thought as to how one makes a livelihood off of a magazine. I'd had some experience running an underground newspaper in the early 70s, but I didn't really make a livelihood off of that either. One of the members of our staff was good at shoplifting steaks, so we were able to stay alive on steaks, potatoes, and water. But I had never really, I hadn't thought about it in terms of having anything even approaching a business model. And by the time we had been doing it, we'd done four editions in 4 years, basically, pretty leisurely pace, but beginning to wonder how to make this successful. And somehow out of this thinking process, this discourse, there was this sense that the computer thing, the hacker thing, the idea the digital culture and the idea that people could hack their own minds and so forth, somehow this linkage seemed to be very dynamic and possible and so forth. So we came up with this idea, Reality Hackers, and made that the title of the magazine, which in terms of trying to make a more successful magazine was, a complete mistake. And it did poorly, actually. High Frontiers was actually doing better than Reality Hackers. One thing you don't do generally in midstream when you're running a publication, right? Because you don't suddenly change your name. I mean, hardly anybody knows you anyway. And start again from scratch. But that's what we did three times. And the third time with Mondo 2000 was the charm, sort of. And that seemed to have hit the public or the alternative public at just the right time.
Well, Mondo 2000 was a very slick and glossy and beautiful magazine. What sort of led you there? How did it become such? It was almost like a fashion magazine.
Yeah, I mean, it was a kind of a process of, you know, we did try to design, you know, off and on really beautiful magazines right from the start. There was the second issue of High Frontiers designed by Lord Knows, which was like a hot pink 11 by 17 magazine with a sort of mutated art link letter on the cover with saying kids do the darndest drugs with a three-armed, three-eared Mickey Mouse holding a Central Intelligence Agency blotter acid tab. But I mean, it was also just an incredibly interestingly designed magazine, very irreverent and very countercultural, I guess, in style, but nevertheless very, very well designed. And we tried to maintain that to the extent that we could. And the issues of Reality Hackers, actually, the second issue of Reality Hackers with Sun Ra on the cover had quite an interesting design. But then with Mondo, after the first issue, we were looking around for an art director, designer, and we came into contact with Bart Nagel, and Allison wanted to hire him. I didn't want to hire him because he didn't have specific magazine experience, but Allison wanted to hire him because he had the right astrological sign. Which turned out to work out very well. And I mean, we just sort of slowly drifted into this dual emphasis on contact, or rather on content and on design and on look and having it be sexy and vibrant and all those sorts of things, which seemed to work pretty well. It did, a lot of the more serious, I suppose, intellectuals and hackers and so forth were a little alienated by some of the fashion stuff. But in terms of getting it out there on the magazine stands and moving it, it seemed to work very well. And one of the surprises for me was it's probably maybe a signature moment in my life in terms of having any thing that smells at all like success was when the first issue came out, which was not the great well-designed edition. It was okay. It had Todd Rundgren on the cover, and we sent it off. We had 20,000 copies printed, which was about where we were at the peak of High Frontiers. And we sent it out, and our distributors came back at us in 3 or 4 weeks and said, send us more. And wow. So, I mean, and that just kept happening. In the next issue, we'd do 30,000 in the same thing, and, you know, kind of kept on doubling for a few issues. I think we were able to create something that was attractive on the newsstands. And I mean, it's such a different time now because people really don't go to newsstands anymore. That was kind of a signature.
Well, they still have newsstands in bookstores. I remember.
They have, but I don't think most people don't show up at them.
Well, I remember the moment I realized you'd really arrived was when I heard you on All Things Considered one afternoon. And I recall you were talking about nootropics, and the guy asked you if you had just taken any, and you said, yeah, can you tell?
Yeah, they were pretty good, some of them. You know, they I'm trying to remember, if I haven't been taking my memory drugs, so I can't remember the names of the drugs anymore. But some of them were pretty good.
Paracetam, that's the one I remember.
Paracetam, yeah. I think
is that it? Paracetam?
Yeah, or Paracetamol.
I guess when,
I think
when,
that was the one I was on.
It.
That was on the one I was on when I did the NPR interview. Yeah, I think it was pretty effective, you know, in terms of being quick and clever and that sort of thing. Now, I'm not sure, you know, it doesn't add to your depth particularly, but, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to absorb a lot of knowledge or whatever. I mean, whether these things are have cumulative intelligence increasing properties or not, you know, is still a subject for, you know, scientific investigation. They have stimulant qualities that aren't as physically detrimental or as they don't have the sort of come down that, say, methamphetamine or cocaine has.
Gave me a headache. We had some of that circulating through our fringewear crowd, and I also had some from Mexico called nootropial, as I recall. But in the fringewear days, actually, pre-fringewear, we had a boing boing panel at Armadillicon, the science fiction convention here in Austin,
right.
And we had a panel with. I guess Mark and Carla from Boing Boing, and Gareth was here, and then Paco and I. We were sitting on that panel, and I guess Paco produced a bottle of, I think it was paracetamol.
Yeah.
And
and
I recall Bruce bounding out of the audience to say, "Hey, I'll have some of that."
And it gave you a headache, huh?
It gave me a headache, yeah.
I was taking it regularly for about 2 years, and at some point, instead of giving me a stimulant effect, it started to make me woozy. I found that to be the case often with these kinds of drugs, or in some cases, not drugs, but the nutrients or vitamins, that if you take them regularly at some point, for me anyway, they start to back up on you. Start having an opposite effect. But the Deprenil was a good one, and Vasopressin was, of course, pretty potent if you can get a hold of it. I turned Bill Gibson out to Vasopressin at something called a Cyberthon put on by the Whole Earth people.
I remember Cyberthon.
Were you there?
Yeah. I wasn't there, but I know somebody named Cheryl Green who was involved in producing that thing, and we were reminiscing about it a little bit. I was reading about it avidly and wishing that I had been there.
Yeah, it was a great fun event. And I got to turn Gibson onto Vasopressin, which he liked. He got the hit off of it right away.
We tried to do a Cyberthon in Austin through EFF Austin, and actually rolled it into RoboFest, which, among other things, led to the creation of Illuminati Online, the IO.com. Which was one of the early, ISPs, Internet Service Providers.
Right.
I'd like to talk about St. Jude a little bit, just because I miss her so much. How did you meet Jude?
Sometime early on, towards in the early days of High Frontiers, she started coming around to the house. Came to be known as the Mondo House, this sort of mini mansion up in the Berkeley Hills that Allison, aka Queen Moo, had managed to stumble upon and rent. And I don't know, she just started coming around, and she didn't really make herself known as a writer or as a potential editor for quite a long time. I think she really started to be integrated into the magazine as a proofreader and as an editor probably around the fourth issue of High Frontiers. And she was, I think, editing some of Morgan Russell's writing and a few other pieces. And I think maybe with the switch towards Reality Hackers, and then the switch towards the more specifically a hacker attitude, with the need for us to get online and all that sort of stuff, she started coming around more to help our push in that direction, and eventually started writing, and turned out to be the funniest writer that we had, you know, just a great writer. Just went from there. I mean, after I sort of quit Mondo, we wound up writing books together. And just a great, great person with a great sense of humor and a very easy person to talk to. And she was kind of a mother confessor to a lot of people, I think.
Yeah, she was pretty great. She wrote Code, too, didn't she?
She wrote Code, yeah, all the way back to, what was that Automat store where you could, like, punch some numbers and get some food out, like in the early 1960s? I can't remember the name of it, but it was these famous restaurants in New York and Long Island, at least, and perhaps some other places. And she actually, you know, pre-digital analog, she actually was very much involved in coding that. And, you know, she was recognized as, she was basically the only female hacker in the book Hackers by Steve Levy, and was very much caught up in, what was the name of the group with Lee Felsenstein?
Cypherpunks.
Yeah, but before that.
Oh, before that? Oh, yeah.
The Berkeley group that out of which, you know, Jobs and Wozniak met and created the Apple and so forth. Can't think of the name right now. But yeah, and then she was involved in Cypherpunks as well. So Jude never knew how she coded. You know, she couldn't, it was transcoding.
She did, it just came, huh? It came through her fingertips?
Yeah, she would just sit down and it would come through her fingertips. I think, I mean, as a writer, I think she was much more conscious. But as a coder, it just came, yeah.
Well, she quite got it. I remember being at the Computers Freedom and Privacy Conference in 93 in San Francisco. And she was there with Eric Hughes. And Cypherpunks was recently formed. And it was like very stimulating, and they were introducing me to people. That's when I interviewed like Phil Zimmerman and Tom Jennings and several other folks who were, those were actually some really great interviews, and they all sort of went on to have very interesting careers. Tom Jennings is still out there. I don't know whatever happened to Phil Zimmerman, but he was the coder of PGP, and they were all like totally whacked out over, especially any kind of cipher. I remember watching a few of the younger guys, like Fiber Optic, were sitting there just kind of poring over the weird little code keys that the hotel had. They were trying to kind of get their heads around the code and figure out how it worked.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like with the earlier 2600 meetings, I went to a couple of them in downtown San Francisco. Everybody would gather around the phone book.
And, yeah, actually, they had one of those. We were like walking through down the street when I was there for that conference, and there was Emmanuel and a bunch of guys clustered around a phone booth having one of their meetings.
So I remember, I mean, there was a statement. I don't think it was Eric Hughes. It was another guy. Some grand statement of cypherpunk about how they were going to overthrow all the governments and elites through encryption.
Yeah, I'm still waiting. I guess WikiLeaks is just an extension of that, right?
Well, I mean, certainly the spirit of that continues. And
Julian was certainly part of the cypherpunks.
Absolutely, and you know, it does become much more difficult for elites to maintain their position. You know, radical transparency and all that definitely seems to be an outgrowth of cypherpunk. I mean, it's a longer, more complicated and more difficult road than sort of dropping an informational liberation bomb in the middle of a culture and everything suddenly becomes free. But it's definitely something that's working in slow motion in its own way.
This might be a good time to bring up this subject of open source politics, which is something that you and I have both talked about before. You want to talk about your vision for that?
Well, back about, I guess it was in 2008, during the primaries, I wrote a piece for Tens and Monkeys. That was a proposal to create something called an open source party. Put it out there, and basically created this scenario. It wasn't Kickstarter, it was something else at the time. And there was a situation where people could donate money, and if you reached a certain amount of money, then you actually got the money. And basically I put out this proposal to start something called an open source party, and we said, if we get $5,000 in donations, we'll actually register this as an organization and go forward with it. And typical, or at least not atypical, internet fashion, there was an explosion of great enthusiasm and many people talking and chattering and being very excited, but nobody making any actual contributions to it. So I let it go. But I mean, basically, the idea is, radical transparency, moving towards, greater democracy, more participation, participatory sorts of democracy, having to combine that with a strong sense of civil liberties, so that you don't have the tyranny of the majority. A grossly simplified version of what I had in mind. I made sort of seven policy points that I used in this particular version of it. Recently I was contacted by a young guy who's in college, he was wondering why this wasn't happening, why we weren't doing this. I started to think, well, yeah, this is a pretty good idea. This may be an idea whose time has come. And in fact, it may be the political strategy and the political movement that might be needed right now. And I think, in terms of, if people can go to Tens and Monkeys and look it up, open source party proposal, and see what I wrote then. But my sense now is to strip the thing bare and to, and Trevor, the college student who contacted me, had been encouraging this, to create a wiki and to just sort of, really just put out some really basic, but just basically say open source party, liberty, democracy, radical transparency, and maybe a few principles of open source politics that I think a certain John Lipkowski has suggested, and just starting over from scratch and seeing what happens with that.
One of the things that I saw in reading that article is very timely, is the point of, let's explore the possibility of an open source monetary system. And the state of the monetary systems in many countries is pretty dismal right now.
Yeah, I mean, we're really being sentenced to, a long period of suffering for the masses, the majority, whatever you want to call them, call us. I think it's become clear to people. I mean, I think in the 90s, somebody like myself, I might have made radical statements and gotten a little on edge about things from time to time. But on a gut level, I probably thought we would get by. I thought that, the corporate centrism of Clintonism, just a rational, elite technocracy running things, we would get by, and we would evolve the technology and the science and the consciousness to and eventually be able to take off from that sort of relatively comfortable base towards a new kind of society. And I think there's a general feeling started to rise up with the Bush administration and really peaked with the economic crash in late 2008 that we won't get by, or that the way in which the new normal within which the political and economic elite assume that we will get by is by accepting as a permanent condition high unemployment, really low wages, and continued squeezing of the public sphere so that we get to shut down education and social welfare and health care and people taking care of the old and infirm and cities and states and fire departments and police departments and et cetera, et cetera. You know, everything in California right now, they're getting ready to really hack everything down to size that's in the social sphere. And meanwhile, huge amounts of wealth are obviously just spurting upward toward to the top and, just staying there.
Right, and the middle class is disappearing.
Yeah, and I do think that, from, the political analysis, the economic analysis, even of people who are called liberal within mainstream culture, is that this is just the way it is, and this is the way it's going to be, and it's going to be acceptable. And I don't think it has to be that way. I don't really believe in the debt and all that. I mean, I understand that it's not simple. It can't just be Zimbabwe and we print a bunch of money and suddenly everybody's happy. It's pretty complicated. But I think this is a process of thinking about it and of people engaging in this kind of open source, participatory process that could get us to the point where our skills and our resources and our hopes and the things we'd like to do and the things we do can be met by the representation, the signifier of value in a way that works for everybody a lot better than it's working now.
You know, one of the other points you make that's really timely is getting rid of corporate parenthood and, unfairly advantaging corporations. And, the Supreme Court basically gave their approval to just, that sort of thing, saying that corporations have more, have equal, if not more, rights than anyone else.
There was a Freudian slip in there. You said corporate parenthood.
Oh, well, I'm sorry.
Corporate personhood.
Personhood. Yeah.
I think that's actually more appropriate, actually.
Yeah, I think that's what I was thinking. It seems that way, that we're the children and the parents are the all-knowing corporations.
Those mature parents who know what they're doing. Yeah, I mean, there are a bunch of good points, I think, in the original document, but I'm not sure that the way to go is with imposing this document on open source situation, but to actually sort of start again from scratch, or we can raise these points, but I think it should be, if we're going to do it, if this thing winds up happening, it should be open from the start, and some of this stuff perhaps needs to be rethought. The other person who I've been speaking to, his name is, I think I can pronounce this correctly, Trevor Tomash, has sent me some notes. And he's emphasizing in his notes the sort of radical democracy idea that I was very cautious about when I wrote my piece. The idea of participatory democracy. I think, his point, as I understand it, is that really the only way you can have radical transparency is by having everybody participating in policy. Otherwise, there's just going to be that gap between what people know about and what's actually being created and discussed. And I was very cautious about that. I know that, one thing, libertarians obviously, but in general, intellectuals are pretty suspicious of participatory and radical democracy because of the fact that a lot of people are really stupid.
Tyranny of the majority, too, that you mentioned before, is much more of an issue if you try to go to some kind of really radical democracy, implementation of democracy or direct democracy. We had a lot of conversations around that when we were doing the extreme democracy work and thinking about how you know, what's the impact of technology? Does it actually facilitate more and better democracy, better participation, and so forth? Well, one of the things it has facilitated is the Tea Party.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that's interesting, actually. I think what we're really understanding is that the technocracy is just, it's not serving us. The idea that a wise, seasoned, technocratic, corporate elite can guide us gently into the future is just seems clearly not to be working. And there are these populist internet-based, largely internet-based movements rising up. And I mean, you saw it in the Netroots movement that put Barack Obama into the presidency and basically has no power over his administration once they helped to put him into power. Immediately they went into the huddle with Timothy Geithner and with the same group of Clintonites and so forth, and govern from that corporate center. And I mean, we like Obama personally, and think that he is probably well intentioned, but I think that we're learning that that kind of politics has run its course. So really, I don't think we have any place else to go but to ourselves and to populism and to radical democracy. And I think we also have to remember that when we introduce this idea that we should have radical democracy and participatory democracy balanced out by a strong civil libertarian rights and so forth.
Right.
That we're at the beginning of engaging in a very, very, very long process. And during that process, people are empowered and educated and hopefully brought up to a certain level of sophistication by the opportunities that they have to participate. Anyway, that would be the hope. I don't really see that there's an alternative other than to sit back and hope that the current elites serve us well, which doesn't seem to be happening.
Well, you have to define participation. I mean, many people wouldn't participate if they had to. You know, they would just rather not, and
yeah.
And they shouldn't be forced to. And yeah. There are people who would participate by standing in the street in a crowd, you know, with a sign or something like that. But that's not really the kind of participation that we're talking about. We're talking about people who really engage and really get their heads around the issues and engage with the issues and begin to understand them. One of the problems there is that there's a whole lot of issues, and they're very complicated, a lot of them. And who's going to be able to get their head around all of them? So somehow we have to find some way to distribute the work of parsing the problems and understanding the problems and getting our reports back, you know, and some way that we can truly participate from a position of understanding. But I don't know. I mean, this is kind of what representative democracy is supposed to be. We vote people in. We're kind of hiring them to go in and do the job of getting their heads around the problem. And some of them really try to, and some of them just don't. You know, so we're really kind of doing, sometimes I think that's the best we can possibly hope to do.
Yeah, I mean, in broad terms, you know, if we engage in this process, we may find ourselves sort of doing finding a way to mix these things together. I mean, when you have representatives, the thing about having representatives is that they can be bought. You know, you can buy 1,000 people. Finance industry or corporations or what have you, people call special interest groups of various sorts can buy the House of Representatives, by the Senate, and in relative terms control a presidential administration, and they can buy mayors and all that. But you know, they can't buy, you know, whatever it is, 300 million people. And if they want to, you know, well, that would be, you know, to the good. If big capitalism felt that they were forced to buy everybody's approval in a really significant way, that would be all to the good. I mean, I think that's what brought about the New Deal era and brought about social democracy in Europe was the sense that there was always the possibility of a populist uprising, and you actually had a communist threat. You actually had workers' movements in United States and Europe, which actually, sort of forced compromise into a kind of social dynamic that created the New Deal and created those social democracies over in Europe.
Well, I guess we may have an uprising, but we're going to have to wait till the summer reruns start, right?
Yeah, well.
Who's got time?
I don't have any time. There's so much damn good stuff on TV.
Are you going to run for president?
No, yeah, probably not.
You did that, didn't you, once before?
I did, yeah, in 2000. I did a sort of a nominal run at it. But I think probably not. If I do, basically, my platform will be to clean up after the Mayan apocalypse and get ready for this technological singularity. Probably not, unless it seems like there's a possibility there for it to be an awful lot of fun. In terms of the open source party idea and all that, I think should not be a cult of personality for anybody. I mean, look at Julian Assange and how messed up he is. And people's interest in joining open source, so joining into this process shouldn't rest on how they think about me or how they feel about me either, if this is going to happen. If it's looks like it's going to be an awful lot of fun. It's always possible that I would do that.
You just gave me an idea for a product that we could sell, post-apocalyptic cleanup kits.
Yeah.
Oh, I'd buy one for sure. You were saying that one of the key words in your presidential statement was it would have to be a lot of fun, because in reality, that's pretty much all you're going to get out of it.
That's right.
The way that they've structured the elective process here in this country.
Yeah.
And well, actually, you could build, if we were going to build an open source party, you could do that, but it takes a lot of work. You can do grassroots now better than you ever could before because of the technology that we have. But, you kind of have to start at the lower level offices and run people for those offices and then kind of have them escalate and move their way up until you get people into national offices. There's a strategy for building a movement or a party that actually can have some force because it actually, gets elected officials.
One of the things, I wrote this piece and I did the original piece on open source party did mention an objection to the duopoly and so forth. But I did perhaps a poor job being clear about this initially, but I wasn't really thinking of it as an electoral party. I was thinking of it more as a movement and that people from open source party could be part of Democratic Party or Republican Party or Libertarian or Green, and then maybe, whatever else is out there, and then maybe eventually become another kind of party. And oddly enough, or ironically enough, the Tea Party has opened up a space for that idea. The idea of, calling something a party brings a certain ballast, certain dynamic to it, but you can call yourself a party and be an electoral party. Although, They obviously are a wing of the Republican Party in truth, but at least conceptually it's an independent movement.
Yeah, the Tea Party's created an interesting and large movement, and they've kind of pointed out a good strategy of just being a bull goose loony and making a lot of noise and doing really outrageous things, which actually is reminiscent a bit of the Yippie movement and a lot of those kinds. You just have to be so outrageous that you seize the airwaves and get your message out.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, I mean, it's painful to watch some of these tactics come back in this form. One of the things I pointed out, I was discussing this with my mother, actually, and I said, but Mom, we were teenagers. These people are like, they're like 60 years old, you know. I mean, you know, obviously Jerry Rubin went around telling people to kill their parents. I mean, I can't believe he actually said that looking back, but I don't think anybody took it seriously. But
well, it may have been in the kill the Buddha sense, you know, not in a really serious sense.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what he meant, but you know, some paranoid schizophrenic, you know, might take things literally. But anyway, yeah, it is interesting to see how those tactics have come back. I'm not sure that that's the way of how for open source party, but certainly, you know, there are ways to grab attention that can be worthwhile.
Yeah, the open source party really needs their own version of the Fox conspiracy. But, you know, Fox News has basically helped create the Tea Party. You need to solicit some other cable channel who wants to go to bat for the open source.
That's true. Yeah, maybe we can get Rachel Maddow behind it or something. But yeah, I said, again, if this is going to happen, I see it as a lot of people in this culture expect sort of instant success or instant fail. I would see this as a pretty long range plan. You know, I think it's intrinsically the politics of the future. I think the emergent economy, the emergent way of being is sort of voluntary collaborationalism. And I think that's what's implicit in our technology and in a lot of the behaviors that we're starting to see with open source with, you know, a lot of different forms of collaboration and with people being willing to throw themselves into non-profitable ventures like, you know, dedicating your life to going to Burning Man or what have you. I think that is an emergent property of the future, and open source party idea is an idea that could meet that future and help to bring it about. Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, well, Clay Shirky talks about the idea that people will do something for love and not just for gain.
Exactly. Yeah, people would rather do something for love, actually, but you know, they you know, people also have to have their bottom lines taken care of.
Well, we have been talking now for about an hour. I think this might be a good time to wrap up. Do you have anything else you want to say? Or talk about?
Well, I just, I'm working on a Mondo 2000 history project, a collective project for people who actually, with participation of people who actually, in some way, some small or large way, were part of the Mondo 2000 experience. So it's kind of a, in some ways, an open source storytelling experiment. And anybody who was a part of that who hasn't heard about it yet, I invite them to participate. It's probably going to take about 3 years, and we're about a half a year into it. So it's going to be a while before anybody sees anything from Mondo 2000 history. And what it will be, there will be an online version where people will probably be able to find the, by the time we're done, find the issues of the magazine in an online format, find some of the publicity that existed, find some of the discussions that have been taking place and will be taking place between participants of Mondo, find video and audio uploaded of various things. I had a lot of tapes, actually, that eventually can hopefully be converted of various interviews that went on, including things like Timothy Leary and William Gibson in conversation. So it'll be, in some sense, almost like an online museum in which we'll select materials from this open process to present. And there'll be a lot of stuff there, and should be very generous. At the same time, there'll be a book, which will be more closely edited, which hopefully will tell the story of the history of Mondo 2000. I get the distinct feeling I'll probably be writing about half of it myself, but I think I can manage it. I think it'll be enjoyable to read, and maybe we'll get a movie out of it, too. I'm still pushing for that.
Written by Aaron Sorkin and directed by David Fincher?
Yeah. I think that I think it's the real Facebook. And
I agree.
Everybody is like, I don't know, who is the character who got high a lot? And I also like to mention that I wrote the lyrics for three songs for a band called SLT, for an album called Gone Dead Gone. I should have been a guru. Everybody must get rehab, and I Politician, I hope people will look that up.
Yeah, well, those are great songs.
Yeah, well, I listen to the songs, and a good way to end any kind of show is leave them with a song. Do you have one in particular you think?
I guess that I should probably play I Should Have Been a Guru.
And should you have been?
Absolutely, man. It would have been an easy way of life.
Should have been a guru. Young girls for the picking. Followers wash my asshole. A grown man weep at my face. I think I could have made it go. Smile always and act like I know the perfect secrets of the cosmic wow. But it's too late to be a guru now. Should have been a guru. Talk shows with Larry King. White robes in a limousine. A long beard and a big ring. I know I could have been at peace. A happy face with perfect teeth. Three eats off the sacred cow. But it's too late to be a guru now. Guru, sitting still up on the hill. No stress, no mess, no sins to confess. No action, no friction. Never watch Pulp Fiction. Just laugh while the people bow. But it's too late to be a guru now. I should have been a guru. Should have been a guru.